This is the Primal King podcast, but first, a quick message.
Crosso Ranch has raised premium beef for 5 generations, but we've always kept it to ourselves, but not anymore. You now have the ability to get ranch-raised USDA certified beef from our mountains in Idaho delivered directly to your dinner table. Don't settle for growth hormones, steroids, or imported beef on the store shelves anymore. Go to crossomeats.com right now to place your order. Your body and your taste buds will thank you for it. Even our girls think it's really yummy.
Buy Crosso Meats. I love it.
Oh, Nanny!
What is up, everybody, and welcome back to the Primal King Podcast. This is episode number 79. All right, so I'm super excited for you guys to be able to listen to the conversation I got to have. This is with someone who is actually from a small town like myself and even had fewer people in his graduating class, which is very rare. But despite that, he's gone on to do some massive things. His newest project is near and dear to my heart. And so I really am excited to be able to share with you guys the conversation I had with Jamie. I think you're going to love him, love what he stands for, love who he is. And so, yeah, super excited. So, hey, let's get started. So the question is this: how do we live the best life that we can with the limited amount of time that we get to be here? Is it by accumulating success and fame and fortune and everything else that society tells us that we need in order to be fulfilled? Or is it much more simple than that? My name's Derek Wilson. I'm the host of the Primal King Podcast, and we're going to be answering this as well as many other questions as we move forward. Welcome back, everybody. Super excited for my guest today. This is someone who is a natural born hunter and an entrepreneur to the core that grew up working on the family farm and commercial quail plantation in Southwest Georgia. After graduating from the University of Georgia, he went on to be an owner in and the CMO of South Capital Partners, which is an asset management company that manages and partially owns bars and restaurants such as the Ivy Buckhead, the Valentine Nashville, the Southern Kitchen and Bar, and the Family Dog. He's also involved in all kinds of cool stuff, things like paragliding, fitness and triathlons, BJJ, and all things outdoors. His recent startup, the Hunter Recruitment Project, is making huge waves by getting first-time hunters out and learning the invaluable lessons that can only be found through self-sufficiency and harvesting an animal. His get off your butt and make it happen attitude is something that I believe we are missing. So I'm super excited to introduce you all to Jamie Shira. Again, Jamie, thanks for coming on.
Dude, what an intro. Thanks for having me. That's awesome.
Yes, no, my pleasure. So you grew up, based on our previous conversation, kind of similar to how I did, you know, a small town, kind of working on the farm. For us, it was more on the ranch. But yeah, I guess, like, just so maybe people understand, because you've gone on to do a lot of awesome stuff, and obviously we'll get into that. But maybe just so people understand, what was kind of like a normal day growing up?
Well, there were no normal days. I mean, when you grow up on a farm, it is, you know, consistently inconsistent. And so, you know, what I mean by that is you kind of wake up at the same time. And from there on, it's something's always broken. Something always needs, you know, fixing. There are cows that break fence. There are horses that need, you know, brushing and cleaning, and dog kennels that need cleaning out. And there's just a constant plethora of things to do. So, you know, I grew up, like I said, in a really, really small town. I graduated with 18 people in my high school.
Oh, man. You're the first person I've ever talked to that has a smaller graduating class. Only by 3, but it is smaller. So that's kind of cool.
Well, for what it's worth, that was one of the smallest graduating classes from my high school. So, you know, it was always laid out to us that regardless of what your decision was, you wouldn't just be able to sit at the house. So when we were too young to play group sports or actually work on the farm, when the sun came up, we went outside, and mom would put lunch outside and put snacks outside. And then when the sun came down, we came back inside. And that's just the way we grew up. You know, we had, you know, bicycles and, you know, four wheelers, and we would build forts out in the woods. And we grew up on a farm. So naturally we had a big shop, right? And the shop had all the stuff that kids probably shouldn't be messing with, like, you know, a TIG welder, grinders, you know, big power drills and everything. So when we built a fort, we would build a fort, grew up in Southeast. So we have these massive oak trees that has this massive expanse. And so we would build like paths from tree to tree and just all this crazy stuff. So as we got older, you started getting into team sports. My dad always you know, said you are either going to play sports or you're going to work. And if you play sports, when you're not playing sports, you're going to work. So regardless, you're going to be doing something. So, you know, we would have practices. You know, I'd have to come home, and especially during the summer, you know, when you weren't in school, it was a constant daily grind. We had to report at 8 a.m. to the gas tank. We had an old gas pump on our farm that was kind of in the center, and that's where everybody gathered out in the morning, and Dad would give out orders of, you know, what needed to be done, what we were working on, and what issues we're dealing with or whatever. And it was kind of an early form, and I obviously had no idea at the time of this consistent daily meeting that is so important in being successful in any organization. You gotta have that constant communication. You gotta have an open area to be able to communicate, you know, because as he's giving out, you know, tasks to this guy, it's like, all right, so what do you need to get that done? You know, just really open forum of communication, but it had an agenda, and everybody knew every morning that's when they had to be there, and that's what they had to talk about, and that's just the way it was. And so that was always a really cool experience for me, to be able to stand there and kind of, you know, at 10, 11, 12 years old, listen to that. I was operating really large, heavy machinery at a very young age. So I learned how to use my hands. I learned how to work with my hands. I think that's something that really, really needs to be added back into our curriculum, is teaching people how to just fidget with things. And, you know, a belt pops off of a lawnmower. What do? Well, yeah. You know, you gotta take the spring out. You gotta put, you know, and so that was it. I mean, we worked, we played sports. I played basketball, football, ran track. Those are my kind of three primary sports, and then rode horses and blew up stuff and did all the stuff that you're not supposed to do as a kid, you know, they say these days, but I think that's what kind of made me who I am today.
For sure. So I remember I worked with a company that was from South Georgia, right? And that was one of the big things that I noticed, is that it wasn't just Georgia, it was South Georgia. It was a big difference, it seemed like, you know. And he was telling me it's family, faith, and football, and it's not always in that order, you know. So I remember, like, geez, okay, it's different. And I'm a huge football fan. In fact, I've coached high school football for years and years. So no, that's always something cool to hear that you grew up that way. So does your family still, like, have a farm? Does your, like, yeah, is that, yeah, all still so, intact? Or
yeah, well, so this past year, my grandparents, my dad's mother and father, who are the kind of matriarch and patriarch of our Shire family, both passed away, 94 or 95 years old. And wow. My grandfather had been in bad shape for a while. So we knew that it was kind of coming. And my aunt and her two sons have taken over that farm. And they still farm cotton, peanuts, and soybeans. And my dad has moved on and bought some other property and doing the same thing. So that's kind of where my dad took a transition. To take a step back, my grandfather was kind of the first person in his family that said, hey, you know, we're going to do things the right way. We're going to put a stake in the ground. You know, we're going to start and try to build something special. And he started with 40 acres and built the house that my grandmother and him lived in, but with his own hands, by himself, you know, had one of his buddies maybe come and help. And my father and his brother, my Uncle Ray, took over that operation. And, you know, when they were at the peak, they were farming somewhere around, I think, like 8,000 or 9,000 acres, which in South Georgia is,
yeah,
huge. Out west, Midwest, it's not, you know, that's like a great farm, you know, but yeah. In Georgia, that's a lot of acreage, especially in the late 80s, early 90s. So that's when I was being born. And, you know, my dad was gone before I was up and got home well after I went to bed a lot of times, but he always made sure that on Sundays, that was his day. You know, we'd get up, we'd have breakfast, we'd go to church. After church, they always took a nap. And if we woke anyone up from a nap, it was a major problem. And then after that, you know, that evening, especially early afternoon, was spent with us. And then obviously during the summer, once you get everything planted, there's kind of a lot more downtime. So Saturdays were spent, you know, doing whatever needed to be done. He was right there along with us, you know, working through all that stuff. So that was kind of the the how I grew up. But I think that's kind of an important component of my story, is that it does take someone to make a decision of, hey, you know, everyone in my family has lived this way for a long time, and that doesn't have to be my story. And that's anybody. And that's anybody at any point, at any time in their life, they can just say, hey, you know, I've made a lot of bad decisions. We've all made a lot of bad decisions. You know, what do I actually want to be? When I sit down and think about what's important to me, what values are important to me, and then how do I design a life around that?
Oh, I love it. I love it. Because I do. I think that, you know, you hear a lot of stuff about generational wealth or generational poverty, and it does. It takes someone saying like, okay, well, that's not going to be my story though. Right. So with you then, because I know for me, my dad was always kind of along the lines of like, you don't want to do what I've done. Right. Like my dad ranched his whole life. He was, you know, and anybody who's listened to the podcast knows, and I, you know, I talk about him a fair amount. You know, he passed away about 4 years ago now, but you know, he was like, get on your horse and go ride. And you've kind of been in this area, it sounds like even where we live, more so than maybe where you go to the out there, what we were just talking about. It's steep, it's brutal. And he would be out there. I remember 1 year riding his horse with like 6 broken ribs. And we had like a 14-hour ride on horses. And so like, I know for him, yeah, it was crazy. And he didn't complain. He was hunched over his horse, but he wouldn't complain. And I remember watching that, just being like, man, I don't think there's anybody tougher than my dad. And I know everybody says that, but it's like that takes some balls, right? Like to be able to do that. But I also know he kind of was like always, I wouldn't say pushing me, but he was always like, there's not a lot of money in what I do. It's really hard. Like maybe go to college and like learn how to be smart. How was it with your dad? Was he that way? Or did he see the value and maybe taking over the farm? Or like what are his thoughts as far as like with where you went to, I guess?
Yeah, a couple things there to note. I mentioned my grandfather and grandmother passed away. My grandfather passed away because about 18 months prior, at 92 and a half, almost 93, fell off a ladder and broke his back in 2 places and didn't tell anyone for like 3 weeks because he knew my grandmother would kill him if she found out he was on a ladder. And so
that's, you know, the toughness that we miss, man. That's the toughness we all miss right now.
I'm not that tough. I mean, I break my back. I'm going to have some, you know, I'm going to have some problems. But you know, my dad, man, he's a tough son of a gun too. He's been, you know, to his own fault, totaled a bunch of cars and, you know, lived a full life. But he always, said that, you know, we have to go to college. He didn't graduate high school. He went to college for 2 years. He wanted to be a vet, loved animals, still does. We've had dogs and horses and cows and pigs and chickens and everything our whole life. So my grandfather was planting with my uncle. And I don't remember the story exactly, but I think had somehow either fell off and broke his arm or leg or something. Anyways, he couldn't work. And that time it's like, all right, well, Tim, you got to come home. You got to finish planting season. Like if we don't plant, if we don't get it in the ground now, we don't have produce, we go broke. Yeah. Like plain and simple. And that's most farmers live that year to year to year basis of like, if we have one major thing that goes wrong, we go broke. And so he never finished college. My mom, on the other hand, went to Georgia Southern University, graduated with a master's in education in 4 years, and became a school teacher, and always had that kind of consistent income, albeit not a whole lot. You know, it was at least consistent, and there's a lot of good pension and all of that when she retired. But my dad was always, you know, I don't care where you go to school. I don't care what you study or what degree you get. You know, we grew up in a bubble. I mean, just a little tiny bubble in South Georgia. And he knew that in order for us to really be able to kind of grow as men, we had to get out, go put ourselves into a whole new community and meet new people and build. And to be honest, the only reason why we've been able to do what we've been able to do is because of that. My brother and I and sister, all three went to University of Georgia. I studied economics at Terry. And that, you know, I remember my very first class, we go in and sit down, and I think there's like almost 400 people in this class, which is more than graduated from my entire high school, you know, and I don't know a single person in there. The teacher walks in, he's just like, hey, I'm so-and-so, this is, you know, whatever. I don't even remember what the class was, you know, here's your syllabus. Class served for the day. See you tomorrow. It's just like, I don't care about you. I don't care about anything that you do. This is what I'm going to teach you. Learn this and you'll pass. And for me, coming from a very small school that was very hands-on and really invested in your education, that was a huge culture shock, you know, and you kind of had to figure it out on your own. And so, you know, that, and that definitely helped, you know, prepare me. I didn't learn a whole lot in college. I didn't take it very seriously, unfortunately, but what I did learn was how to think and how to solve problems and how to meet people and build relationships. And that's invaluable in life.
For sure. No. And see, and that's always the hard thing that I struggle with, right? Is that I think that, you know, as a parent and now me having kids, like you always want your kids to do better than you, which I think a lot of times we look at it means they should do different than you, right? But then it's like, you know, we start losing all these family farms because it's if you're one of those guys who's out there working 16, 18 hours a day on a farm or on a ranch, it's really hard to be like, now kids, this is what you should do. You should work your entire life away and not make any money. You know, I don't think most parents would say that, but then there's the other side of it. It's like, well, somebody has to do it or else we don't have food, right? Like how are we ever going to sustain as a country? So where do you find the balance of that? Like, have you ever thought like, you know, maybe I would have been okay just trying to be a farmer, right? I mean, obviously you've gone on to do other things because I've had that thought as well. Like when I left and I got into, you know, the software stuff and internet marketing, sales, all that stuff before I walked away from it, there was always like a part of me that's like, you know, you maybe won't be a millionaire, but you also see a lot of people that live a very fulfilled life. And so like, what's your take on that balance?
Well, it's funny you asked, because right now, we just started this HRP thing and I am like having this mental shift to figuring out how I can do more of what I grew up doing. As far as a balance, I think you have to figure out as a person, as an individual, we're all different. Everyone's completely different than the other person. You got to figure out what makes you happy. You got to figure out what you somewhat enjoy doing. I don't believe in the whole, like, if you do something you love, you never work a day in your life. That's bullshit.
Yeah. 'Cause
I love what I do and I hate 80% of it, but the 20% of it that gives me enough satisfaction to continue doing it is why I stick in it. But I think you have to figure out what your priorities are as a person and what's most important to you, and then design your life around that, right? If it's freedom of schedule, if it's being outdoors, if it's, you know, grinding, you know, 15 hours a day, if it's, you know, you want to be in finance, you know, obviously you can't really be a big time financial advisor if you live in South Georgia and you're not going to be able to, you know, spend a lot of time outdoors working with your hands with animals if you live in Buckhead, Atlanta, where I live. And so I think that for each individual, it differs. It depends on what's important for you and what you want to do. But it's really funny you ask that question, because I've been in Atlanta. I've been in the rat race now for going on almost 11 years. Moved here in 2010, like April, right after my finals, and opened our first business that September. And it's just been nonstop since then. And I enjoy it and I love it. Every year
there was that butt, like, was there for me too, Jamie. I'm telling you,
I get like 5% closer to getting back, you know, and me and my fiance are having this, you know, this keeps kind of coming up. Like, do we want to stay in our house? Do we want to sell it? If we sell it, where do we move? And we don't really want to stay here or there, you know, and we're just navigating this kind of 1 month at a time. But yeah, it's a
wild process. Yeah, I mean, when we made the decision to move back to the ranch and buy out my stepmom and that whole crazy story, that was kind of the way it was for us. Because again, like, we had a great life. Like, made plenty of money, had all the the stuff that you want, right? That everybody wants, the vehicles, the house, blah, 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 right? But there was like, there was that but, like you just said, but like, gosh, what about that life living back at the ranch? And what about that simple? And then it just, it went from 5% to like 10% and then to like 20%. Yeah. And then I remember telling my wife, like, I think we should move back. And she's like, no, you know, because she'd never lived anywhere close to this small.
Yep.
And it is wild because, you know, and I'm so thankful for all the experiences that we had to be able to get away, be able to meet a bunch of awesome people and have the experiences that I did. But it's funny how it was always something kind of like tugging at me to come back. Yep. And so for us, and again, I think it goes to your point, right? Is you know, what is it that fulfills you, that makes you happy, that you find joy in and all of that stuff. And yeah, I mean, like you said, everybody was like, oh, just live your dream, man. Like there's so many days here. It's like, what the hell are we doing? I want to go back to my nice house. I want to go back to, you know, working in an office where everything's easy. So no, I get all of that. I do want to kind of transition though, because like with the Hunter Recruitment Project, this is stuff that I absolutely love. There's a lot of people in some of these small towns like, we already got too many damn hunters. But I also understand the value in hunting and whether you harvest or not, just the value in it. So maybe if you wouldn't mind, would you kind of take us through what your thought process was, even kind of getting this thing going?
Yeah. So it actually started at out there 2 years ago. I met a guy named Brandon Lilly, who you've probably become familiar with at some point via social media, is like one of the world's strongest guys at a point in his career. And we just hit it off. And over again, the last couple of years, I've just had that tug, like you said, in the back of my head, like, you know, and I've spent more and more time in the outdoors. When I went to school, I kind of quit hunting and fishing because there was always something else to do. I work, take a step back. I was really bright and first semester made a 2.0 and lost Hope Scholarship, which in Georgia pays for all of your tuition. And my dad basically said, well, you can either get a job and pay for it yourself, or you can come back and work. And when you make enough money, then you can go back to school. At that point in
that
time,
never works.
On the farm,
I can tell
was
you that,
not.
That, once you decide to take a break and make some money and go back, it very rarely actually happens that way.
and I'd seen that happen a ton with family and friends and just people in that area. And I said, you know, I'm not doing that. I need to just figure it out. I need to figure out how to stay in school. Yeah. And so I started working in a bar, working the door, cleaning up the worst imaginable stuff you can clean up. We're way worse than working on a farm. And slowly worked my way up into management and, you know, basically took that into this, you know, this whole community that I'm in now. But I just completely quit hunting. And I didn't realize that I missed it until after probably about 2 or 3 years in Atlanta, when I finally could like take a breath, like, okay, like we've got our places open, they're running, you know, we were still opening places and growing different businesses, but it wasn't just like the first 2 years of opening your first restaurant is a pure nightmare. And so I found this, you know, peace in me. I found my love for that hunting again, and just being outside, being outdoors. And it just like, it just grabbed a hold to me. And I noticed that I'm putting stuff up on social media and I've got, you know, a bunch of friends in Atlanta that, you know, they're from Georgia. Of course they grew up hunting, you know, and I'm just getting DM, you know, after DM, after DM, man, this looks awesome. I'd love to come join you sometime. Or this looks great. I would love to be a part of that, you know, over and over and over again. And so I went to out there. And then that following spring in February, I got invited to Winter Strong, which Brandon's part of the Soar Next team, and it's focused more on hunting. And I saw so many people from so many different walks of life kind of come together and say, you know, how do I get involved? And so that event coupled with how many people had asked me, and then I'm starting to get all these DMs like, hey, what bow do you use? Hey, what about this? How do you do this? You know, first time hunters that have never had an experience, and was on the phone with Brandon one day trying to figure out, you know, how is it going to have an impact in the outdoor industry? And this is what just kind of came out of that. And for me, I knew that I wanted to get people in the outdoors. I didn't know whether it, you know, there's 100 different people doing outdoor retreats and camping and outdoor survival stuff, there aren't a lot of programs introducing new hunters into the community, especially adult hunters. You know, and now there's all this like social media stuff against, you know, late onset adult hunters, blah, 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 blah. Well, that's stupid to me, because the only people that are going to be able to pay for themselves and make their own decisions and drive their own cars, buy their own equipment, tags, and go hunting are adults. And so I just tried to figure out what the best way to doing that. And for me, I shot my first deer when I was 6.5 years old, and I still remember I don't remember anything else from 6 years old. I remember that I was asleep in a double ladder stand. My dad elbows me, says, "There's a deer." I'm laying like this. I kind of wake up, turn, and there's an 8-pointer, like 100 yards right there. He's got the rifle already laid across his arm. You know, I'm like, just start vibrating, stand start shaking. You know, I shoot the deer, one shot, went over backwards, dead. And just, I mean, I'm still getting that emotional response. And I knew that there's no way that I can replicate that through a camping trip or a survival school or whatever. And so I wanted to share that emotion with people. And so that's where the Hunter Recruitment Project came in. You know, we take this little R3 model that a lot of these outdoor groups, you know, recruitment, reactivation, and retention. So getting new people, bringing people back that haven't hunted since they were kids, that went with their grandfather because their dad didn't hunt or whatever, and then keeping those people. And so for us, I don't consider it success unless that person that we take goes the following year and purchases a tag, because that money from purchasing the tag goes directly into conservation. Yep. And that's kind of the ultimate goal, right? I'm not trying to create new hunters for anything other than continuing the flow of money into conservation, because as soon as we stop that money flowing into conservation, we're going to have a major issue on our hands with our ability to hunt. And that's, you know, one of the main arguments of the firearm industry and 2A is like, well, we have firearms because we hunt. Well, as soon as you take that away, why do you need firearms? You don't need to protect yourself. The government will do that.
Yeah.
Okay.
We can go down a rabbit hole on that one too. Next time we'll talk on that one.
Stick that one in there.
I was going to say, I got lots of thoughts on that part of it too. But what do you think it is though that gives you that feeling? Because I think that if there's someone maybe listening to you right now that's never hunted, you can't describe it, right? You can't describe when you hunt all day and you finally, you know, whether it's a bow and arrow with a, you know, an elk or a deer or whatever, like what in us like gives us that feeling? Cause I know there's people who are like a bunch of redneck hillbillies, you know, blah, 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 but it's not, it's almost like something, I know it's like Primal King podcast, right? But it is, it's like primal to want to hunt and provide. Like what are your thoughts on why you talk about having that response?
It is one of the most natural things that we can do. Okay. If you look at the entire ecosystem, it's bigger, smarter things, faster, stronger things, eating weaker, less smart, whatever. And I don't think that I'm any smarter than a South Georgia whitetail, because they're pretty cunning little animals. But it's like providing shelter, right? It's providing food. It's, you know, procreating. I mean, those are the most basic things that we can do as a society. The only reason why there is even a, and it's a terrible argument, but the only reason why there's an argument that you don't need to hunt is because we're so disconnected from what, you know, the food sources that we have. I grew up on a farm. I've seen mass farming. I know how it works. You want to talk about something inhumane, we can go down that path. There's a lot of people that do it right. There's a lot of people that do it wrong. And most of the people that are eating meat are eating it from those places that are doing it wrong, because it's cheaper. It's easier access. Now, I think that when you take another animal's life, I think that there is, you know, there's obviously a bit of sadness and mourning that goes into it. But when you talk about hunting, that's not all you're talking about, right? It's from the getting the new camo jacket, right? It's the hiking miles during the off season. It's shooting your bow hundreds and thousands of times every year, trying to be as proficient as possible. It's taking the animal, right? That's only halfway through the journey. It's cleaning the animal. It's processing the animal. It's serving it, cooking and serving the animal to your family. And more importantly, to your friends that have never tried it before. You know, I had a friend of mine move down the road from me, you know, the only guy in my neighborhood that's about my age. And I invited him over for dinner one night, and we had some steaks, and I cooked a venison tenderloin. Neither he or his wife had ever had a venison tenderloin. And if you've never had it before, there's this guy called the flip flop guy. He has this flip flop sauce. And you have the dog barking.
That's all right.
Anyways, you take that and sous vide it with a tenderloin and then sear it in a cast iron skillet. And it's like the best thing you've ever eaten. But their response sitting at the dinner table, they're eating the venison and it's better to them than the steak. And to me, that's like, it's that whole process. You know, people just want to look at, you know, just the killing of the animal. Right. I mean, you have to kill an animal to be a successful hunter, but it's not all there is to it. Right. Yeah. And especially if you, you know, if you do spend a lot of time and energy and money and effort into conservation, that is the fruit of your labor. Right. When I plant a seed in the ground and I water it and I give it fertilizer and I kill all the weeds and all that, and then I can break off a big ear of corn and eat that. That's a very similar feeling of just utter accomplishment, self-reliance. You respect kind of nature a heck of a lot more. You know, everybody says, oh, people that hunt, they don't respect nature. They don't respect animals. Man, I mean, my dad, you know, who taught me most of this, has spent an entire, probably two fortunes on conservation, you know, feeding, habitat management, you know, prepping, you know, food plots, all that, you know. And you've got people that eat meat, first of all, mass produced meat, and then they want to say that you killing an animal is inhumane.
The crazy thing to me is that I think it comes back to what you're talking about with people being disconnected from their food, not just from their meat. I mean, one of the reasons why we started our direct to consumer meat business was partially for that reason. The other, the cattle industry and getting screwed, blah, 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 all of that. Mm-hmm. But it was like, we want people to know if they buy from us, like how it was raised, and they can be connected to their food source, even though, let's face it, most people that buy meat from us will never be able to have their own farm, their own ranch to raise their own.
Right.
But at least they can know through maybe our Instagram or social media, like how we do it, and they can have that connection. I think a lot of it is the same with hunting, right? Because someone who says that they're against hunting, typically the same people, and this may be a generalization, but typically it's the same people who are saying, yeah, I believe all things are living things, right? And then I'm like, okay, well, if all things are living creatures or beings, that plant that you're eating must be living too then, right? So why is it any less humane to kill a deer than it is to kill that living plant? Right. And so that's the thing, that there's just so much hypocrisy, I guess.
Well, if you want to take that a step further, if you've ever run a large farm, the amount of animals that are killed during harvest season.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you're talking, I mean, because all living things are equal.
Mice, grasshoppers, rabbits,
birds, I mean, tens of thousands.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So if each life is equal, I kill one deer, two deer, and it feeds my family for a year. I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not a good argument in my opinion, but you know,
the thing that I worry about, and is it a conspiracy? I don't really think so, but maybe some people view it that way. But it's like, the less centralized control that anybody can have, whether that's government, companies, whatever, on your food source, I think the better off we are. And the only way to combat that, in my opinion, is to know where your food comes from, be able to provide it for yourself, you know? And I think it does. So like within the Hunter Recruitment Project, if you wouldn't mind, because again, I know that a lot of people that listen to the podcast are hunters, outdoorsmen, stuff like that. But maybe when you take somebody, like, what is it like when someone first goes hunting? Like if you could, I know you talked to me about, I think it was a gal from Seattle maybe, but what was that process like for her?
Well, and I want to take a step back, because one thing that we are fortunately seeing are a lot of people who do have the argument that, you know, they don't like hunting, but they also are very conscious of what they're eating, and they see, like, if I'm going to eat meat, I'm going to go through that mental struggle of killing an animal so that I know that I gave that animal a respectful death, and what I'm eating is something that I have killed and processed and put in my own body. I think that's where a lot of new hunters are coming from. And I couldn't be happier about that, but you know, on her name is Nicole, you know, had never hunted before. You know, it was, I mean, this is like, you know, I don't want to embarrass her, but it's like, you know, taking a new kid hunting, like she's so excited about the idea. She's just very like energy forward person anyways. And her personality is just blossoming with excitement. It's she just contagious to be around, but you know, she's like looking around. She's like, oh, you know, and I didn't take her, Baker took her. And he's sitting in the stand and he's just like, every 10 seconds, he's like, you gotta be quiet. Like, be still. But you know, an animal steps out, she shoots the animal, kills it dead. And I've got a video on my phone of kind of the tailgate talk, right? So there were two other people I think it had killed, or maybe one other person had killed a deer. And it was the last day, last evening, the weather was like the worst weather possible. And she's like a kid on Christmas, just like, oh my God, I cannot believe this happened. I'm so excited. You know, and then, you know, one of the parts of the hunter recruitment project that we focus on heavily is a mentor-mentee relationship. So you don't just come and hunt once. Everyone has everyone's cell phone number. You become friends. When you share a camp with people, you've done that before. You understand the camaraderie and relationships that are built from there. So, you know, still to this day, she's sending me messages of, you know, like, look at this sausage. This stuff's so good. Look at this venison. You know, I cannot wait to do this again. But for me, it's, you know, I eat venison almost every day. But taking someone else on their first time, I mean, I shot my biggest whitetail this year with my bow. Huge accomplishment for me. It was like such an awesome experience. I think I got more excited when any one of our new HRP people, mentees, shot a deer. It's just, you just see like this childlike excitement and awe of, I don't know. I feel like you maybe don't truly understand the value of life until you take it from something else, and the power that that has and the respect that it deserves. And so I think there's this just like confluence of, you know, all these emotions that your brain's never processed before. And it's just, you're kind of overwhelmed, and you know, people cry, people shake. I mean, I still to this day, like, oh God, I get all, you know, shit and jittery and just like freaking out. And if I ever lose that, I'll be done hunting. I mean, it's such a massive component to, especially a new hunter coming in, to see that it's okay for that. You know, it's okay to be upset or you know, sad or whatever. But as long as you treat that animal with respect, you clean it properly and process it, eat it. I mean, that's again, one of the most natural things we can do.
Well, I think it is important. Like you said, like I'll never forget when I took our first load of steers to get butchered. Right. And I mean, these are like critters that you feel like you raised since they were little.
And
it's like, man, this is actually kind of sad. Like, I shouldn't be sad about some stupid steers. You know, they're big, dumb animals. And like, I'm like driving down the road, because where we do the USDA processing is like 2 hours away from us. And so I'm like, man, I'm literally like sad about this. Yep. And again, like you said, I think that's a healthy emotion. Like, I think it's okay to be sad about killing something, yet understand it is part of what sustains us. To me, that's a hell of a lot better than just going and buying a steak and there's no attachment to what you're eating. You have no problem throwing it away because it doesn't mean anything to you. All it was a few dollars, right? And so, no, I absolutely love that side of it. With with going through this as well, because like the experience of it, right? If there's one thing that I wish that everyone could have the feeling of is having a, like a bull elk bugling at you from like 20 yards away or 30 yards away. I mean, literally it's giving me chills right now, just thinking about it.
Oh yeah.
Cause it's unlike anything. And I know that there's awesome stuff with deer hunts and everything else, but like how do people process the feeling of just like that environment and being within kind of that camaraderie?
I think if you're talking to elk hunting, I don't think they process it very well. I know I don't process it very well. I've still never killed one with my bow. But I've shot an elk with my rifle, and there is, I mean, the only emotion that I can relate closely is a turkey gobbling that you didn't know was there like 20 yards away, and you literally jump wherever you're sitting. Obviously an elk can just bury you in the ground, whereas a turkey, you know, it's going to run off. But that is one of the most powerful experiences I've ever, you know, had is a bull running up a hill at you, you know, thrashing trees and just going absolutely ape in the woods. And so, I mean, you know, whitetail, it's obviously a different hunt. I mean, when I shot my buck this year, he was grunting and running and trying to fight, you know, sticks on the ground. He was full blown rut. A lot of the does, obviously, you know, it's not that same experience, but being it a first time, I don't think it doesn't matter. And when you get into that camp environment and everyone has their own little nuance to their own story about what happened, and you start relating other experiences in life that had a similar compounding effect on the development of your character and who you are as a person, that's what creates community, right? Being able to communicate and then relate experiences with each other. And, you know, I think it starts at the home with the family, you know, sitting down and having meals, and that's going by the wayside a lot. And, you know, if I can help facilitate that in any way possible, that's kind of the, you know, kind of a intended side effect of hunting. Mm-hmm. And it's bringing awesome people together to do something that half of them have never done before, to create an experience and a relationship that's irreplaceable. You know,
I think hunting camp is just something to where, like you said, you know, you go out and you hunt all day and then you come back and maybe you have a couple of beers or whatever and you talk about it. And like you said, it just bonds people like nothing else. Like, you know, you'll know people, and then when you hunt with them, you'll actually know them, right? like it's one of those things where it's like, you might think you know someone, go spend a day or two out in the mountains and camp and, you know, have a couple of beers and let the real truth come out. Then you actually know people. And again, people that don't hunt don't ever really have that opportunity, right?
Well, what have we done as a society for thousands of years?
Yeah, hunted.
We've gone and hunted stuff. We came back and drink some weird fermented drink that we had, or smoked a peace pipe or whatever, and told stories.
Yep.
And that's how our history has been built over thousands and thousands of years. And when you eliminate, separate, and segment people into their little apartments all over the world, you eliminate a lot of the things that make us realize we're not so different from each other.
Right.
No matter what your opinions are, no matter what your concerns are, no matter what, you know, you think about certain topics, at the end of the day, we're like 99% the same, you know. Yeah. And until you can sit down and break down those barriers, you don't ever realize that. And when you look at someone through this thing, you know, through your phone and through their perceived version of themselves on social media, and then what that looks like to you, and you form an opinion thousands of miles away, you've never even had a communication with this person, you already have a very firm opinion of who they are and what they do and what they think and how they feel. And unfortunately, you know, it's devised to send you a certain thing, you know, to see.
Yeah.
It's a really sad deal to see, you know. And Bert Soren from Sorenex, one of their kind of key tenets of Winter Strong is sets. So like lift the weight, you do sets, struggle, eat, and then talk, right? So yeah. Struggle through the mountain, I mean, you hike 12, 13, 14 miles a day when I live at 280, you know, feet above sea level and I'm at 10,000 feet. That is a struggle.
Yeah.
Then you sit down and you eat. And then, you know, you have a couple beers, you know, whatever you have, and then you talk. And there is no other, you can't shortcut that true connection. And that's what, you know, that's what hunting is to me a lot, is building relationships with people that don't necessarily think and see things like I do, and trying to find new perspectives on things.
Well, it's funny because, you know, a friend of mine who I kind of knew, and then he ended up coming out and we did some hunting together. I mean, like politically, a lot of different views, polar opposite. Man, yep. We had the best time ever and way better friends now because of that. And it's like you said, it's like if we only knew each other through social media, we'd probably, you know, you would want to think you wouldn't even like each other, right? We don't believe the same thing. You come together, you go hunt. Again, you have a few beers. We go cruise around in the mountains. Before you know it, it's like, hey, like, do we just become best friends? Well, yeah, because we're out here doing this stuff, right? So I want to start wrapping it up here. I know we got to get out of here. First of all, where can everybody find you? If they want to help support, I know, like I said, a lot of people listen to this that are in the hunting space. Like, if they want to help support your project, like, where can they find you? Where can they follow you?
Yeah. So we have on Instagram, Hunter Recruitment Project, and then an email. If you'd rather shoot an email to hunterrecruitmentproject@gmail.com. Right now we are almost full on our slate of events and people included in those events for this year. You know, one of the struggles for me for this thing is going to be how to scale it properly. I believe in proximity and I like to be close to what I have, you know, that I'm involved in. And unfortunately there's just so much amount of time. So being able to find these camps in these other states to be able to spread it out is going to be a huge component for us. And, you know, personally, my Instagram is Jamie Shira, JameyShirah. And you can find me there. And it's a lot of hunting and HRP stuff and information about that as well. You know, we've just started turkey season here and we've actually got an event in 2 weekends, fly fishing. We've got a guy by the name of Paul Bork, who is a world-class fly fishing instructor and actually was the Team USA fly fishing instructor and won like bunch of world championships and stuff. So he's going to be teaching a bunch of people that have never held a fly rod how to fish. And and you know, that's the goal. I think the way that you can help our mission the best though is to dedicate yourself to take somebody hunting this year. That's dedicate yourself to take the time out of your day, out of your weekend, take someone hunting, because I guarantee you if you've hunted any time at all, you're going to enjoy that more than going yourself, first of all. And then if somebody is able to kill an animal, it's going to be just as impactful on you as them. So
That's good stuff. So obviously on the podcast, we like to talk about, you know, liberation mindset, lifestyle, kind of living the way that you want to live. I guess for you, you know, you grew up on a farm and you went to college, got educated, obviously you've done well. With what you've done kind of post education, I guess, if you want to call it that, and now moving into this, you know, kind of the third pillar of this, like, what do you want as you look back about everything maybe you've done and what you're looking to do now? Like, what do you feel like you want your legacy to be?
So, it's funny you ask. So we do this exercise called the funeral exercise with all of our management members. And basically that is, if you want to figure out what's really important to you, and you have to do that in order to design the life that you want, imagine yourself dying. Okay. And the people that are going to get up, first of all, who are those people? Second of all, what are they talking about? What are they saying about you? What are the key words that they use? Right. And for me, we built our core company values, which are grit, rapport, credibility, resourcefulness, and having a servant's heart, based on an amalgamation of the three kind of brain trust at the top level of our company. And that's really what's important to me. I mean, my personal one includes, I want to be known as a caring, loving, kind person. I want to be charitable. and give back to those that you know aren't as fortunate or whatnot. In order to do that, I've got to, you know, be successful myself. So, you know, all those other core competencies come in there. But that's really the way that I look at things. I said it at the very beginning, you know, if you're at a point in your life that you're not happy, sit down and do this. Sit down, write out, who are the people? Is it your dad? Is it your mom? Is it Martin Luther King? Is it, you know, whoever it is? And then what would they say about you, right? And these people don't have to be alive. They can be dead. What would they say? What are the specific words? And then drill that down into creating core values for yourself. Once you have those core values for yourself, what do you stand for? What's important to you? Then you can build a mission statement, right? And you do this for businesses. Most people don't do this for their lives. It's something that has changed my life completely over the last 5 years, is write down that mission statement. And then that's your affirmation. You know, I do a daily journal, and one of the components is my affirmation, and it's what I'm focused on. And that it changes from year to year, right? I can, you know, maybe I knock something out of the park that's really bothering me that I really need to improve about myself, and I just crush it that year and it's no longer an issue. Well, I don't need to keep working on that, right? So I change it to the next year. And I like to do this about every 6 months. The first ones that, you know, I do it in December. You know, a lot of people do their New Year's resolutions. They start in January. I like to start mine in December, get a little head start on it. So that when January hits, you know, I've already kind of ramped up. And plus you have that weird zone between Thanksgiving and New Year's where everybody's kind of like, I don't know, do we work?
Not doing anything.
Yeah. And people won't answer the phone or email. So you've got 2 whole weeks you know, or, you know, after Christmas to really be able to dial in, you know, those key components of that following year. So.
Oh, I love it. I love it. All right, guys. So make sure you go out, check out Jamie at Jamie Shira on Instagram, at Hunter Recruitment Project on Instagram. Follow along, a lot of good stuff there. And Jamie, again, thanks. That was an awesome conversation. I can't believe how fast the time went. So
I know you said we're about to wrap it up. I was like, wait, what time is it? No, I really appreciate you giving, you know, the Hunter Recruitment Project a voice. It's, you know, it's hugely important to our ability to continue hunting throughout, you know, the next few generations. So thank you again. And I really appreciate your time.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll have to do it again.
For sure. I'll see you, in a few months. A
couple months, right?
August 5th. Yeah. Awesome.
Awesome.
It'll be great to meet in person.
Yeah, for sure. All right, everybody. Well, hopefully you enjoyed this one. We'll talk to y'all soon. Thank you, everybody, for listening to another episode of the Primal King Podcast. There is one thing that I will ask you to do. Please make sure that you are subscribed to the show so you get all of the new episodes coming out. Also, please make sure that you rate and review the show so that way other people can have access to this podcast, to this content, and this community. Again, thank you everyone for listening, and we'll see you next time.